The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
An explosive day in Washington. Ambassador Gordon Sondland says everyone, from the president on down, knew what was going on in Ukraine.
Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
The Democrats say today's testimony points directly to bribery. Some House Republicans offered a different take.
Ambassador Sondland, you are here today to be smeared.
And believe it or not, the world keeps on going on outside of Washington. Helsinki is taking on Silicon Valley with a massive international tech conference. It's more nightclub than PowerPoint.
It's dark, so there's no lights on. There's a lot of lasers. The air is a little bit hazy.
Wooing global startups Finnish style. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. He gave $1 million to Donald Trump's presidential inauguration, and he landed his dream job as Trump's ambassador to the European Union. But today, Gordon Sondland stepped into a spotlight that was not part of that dream.
Was there a quid pro quo?
Sondland himself put the question out there and answered it right away in his opening statement. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the proceedings today, and he joins me in the studio now. How did Sondland answer his own question there, Matthew?
Sondland started out by saying that he was following the president's orders, that President Trump told him and other U.S. officials working on Ukraine to talk with Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, even though they didn't want to talk with Giuliani. Giuliani was apparently talking to the Ukrainians and telling them that he was demanding an investigation into Burisma, the energy company, and the 2016 U.S. elections. So Sondland asked rhetorically today, was there a quid pro quo?
The answer is yes. Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election. Mr. Giuliani expressed those requests directly to the Ukrainians, and Mr. Giuliani also expressed those requests directly to us. We all understood that these prerequisites for the White House call and the right White House meeting reflected President Trump's desires and requirements.
So when Sondland is referring to we there, Marco, he's referring to himself, to former Special Envoy for Ukraine Kurt Volker and Energy Secretary Rick Perry. They're the so-called, you probably heard this, the three amigos who were working on Ukraine policy for the Trump White House.
So at one point, Sondland said he was proud to be a part of this trio of high-level officials for Ukraine policy. But the thing we've heard from others in these hearings is that they were very troubled by this irregular channel of diplomacy and how it was all operating. What did Sondland have to say about that?
Right. This is another key thing that Sondland wanted to get across. He wanted to defend his role in this whole story. He even took issue with the very idea that he was part of an irregular channel at all.
I'm not sure how someone could characterize something as an irregular channel when you're talking to the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff of the White House, the Secretary of Energy. I don't know how that's irregular. If a bunch of folks that are not in that channel are aggrieved for some reason for not being included, I don't know how they can consider us to be the irregular channel and they to be the regular channel when it's the leadership that makes the decisions.
What's significant here is that Sondland's saying, yes, there was a quid pro quo, and that all of these high-level Trump officials were also in the loop on that, that they knew what was going on, a pressure campaign to get the Ukrainian President Zelensky to announce these investigations.
And when Sondland talks about investigations, what exactly is he talking about?
Sondland says that over time, he came to the conclusion that Trump wanted Zelensky indeed to publicly announce these investigations into Burisma and into the U.S. 2016 election, and that when he heard the word Burisma, the energy company that Hunter Biden was on the board of, Sondland said that he didn't associate that immediately with the Bidens. He also talked about the unblocking the $400 million in U.S. military aid for Ukraine. on Burisma, he was asked about that with some real skepticism. Here's a back and forth with the Democratic chairman, Adam Schiff.
Are you saying that for months and months, notwithstanding everything Rudy Giuliani was saying on TV and all the discussion with Rudy Giuliani, that you never put Burisma together with the Bidens?
I didn't, and I wasn't paying attention to what Mr. Giuliani was saying on TV. We were talking to him directly.
So the Democrats clearly got more ammunition from Sondland for the case they're making in the House. But what about the Republicans, Matthew? What did they focus on when it was their turn to put questions to Ambassador Sondland?
So Donald Trump himself weighed in today. The president said that Gordon Sondland is someone he doesn't know very well. Trump also quoted from a phone call that he'd had with Sondland, one that Sondland told House investigators about today, in which the president said, quote, "I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell President Zelensky to do the right thing." That phone call, by the way, was in September. That was after news came out about the military aid being on hold. Inside the House chamber today, Republican counsel Steve Castor tried to downplay the importance of Sondland's testimony with this line of questioning.
Did the president ever tell you personally about any preconditions for anything?
No.
Okay, so the president never told you about any preconditions for the aid to be released?
No.
The president never told you about any preconditions for a White House meeting?
Personally, no.
You said you didn't have your records or your documents from the State Department, but if you did, there wouldn't be any document or record that ties President Trump personally to any of this, correct?
Boy, I don't want to speculate what would be.
No, your documents or records.
I don't recall anything like
okay.
that.
Okay. No. Good heavens. Okay.
So in previous testimony, Matthew, we learned about a direct phone call between Trump and Sondland that took place on an unsecured cell phone in a restaurant in Kyiv. And in that phone call, Trump allegedly talked about Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, opening investigations into the Bidens. What do we hear about that from Sondland?
That's something Sondland did not mention, remember, when he testified for House investigators behind closed doors. So today, Democratic counsel Daniel Goldman asked Sondland about the phone call.
One of the things that you now remember is the discussion that you had with President Trump on July 26th in that restaurant in Kyiv, right?
Yeah, what triggered my memory was someone's reference to ASAP Rocky, which was, I believe, the primary purpose of the phone call.
Certainly. So that's one way memory works, isn't it?
That's a reference to the American rapper ASAP Rocky. He was arrested in Sweden this past summer on assault charges. Trump had called for his release. Mm. The phone call they were just talking about took place one day after the phone call, the July 25th phone call between Trump and Zelensky. Sondland today said he didn't dispute that restaurant phone call took place, but he said that he doesn't remember Trump mentioning the Bidens specifically.
What a wild day. The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Iranians are used to cheap gasoline, so Saturday morning was a shock. The price at the pump tripled. Iranians took the streets to protest, and a brutal crackdown followed. Amnesty International says that in recent days, Iranian security forces have killed more than 100 demonstrators in 21 cities, and authorities have all but shut down the internet. We reached out to Sayed Mohammad Mirandi, an Iranian government supporter who teaches at the University of Tehran. He was critical of how Iran's government carried out the price hike.
Hey. Didn't inform people beforehand. We woke up in the morning seeing the price went up threefold. So this caused anger among ordinary Iranians and many went to the streets. But the riots began on day two and then the protests ended then and the protesters went home because they didn't want to be associated with it. The riots were very well organized. Teams would take out banks one after another within minutes. They went from building to building. And if people stood in their way, they would deal with them. So ultimately, after 2 days, the police and other security services discovered the different networks, arrested many of these people. Some of them were killed. They attacked police stations. So a number of them were killed while attacking a number of police stations.
All right. So if those riots have now stopped, why is the internet still down? And why was it taken down in the first place?
The internet has been used by the rioters to move their people around and to organize their groups and to carry out attacks. So when they're being used against the public, the Iranian police have nowhere to turn to, so they have to shut down the internet so that their supporters outside cannot guide them and they cannot be coordinated inside the country.
It's impossible for those of us outside Iran to know what's going on, mostly because of the internet shutdown. There are some suggestions online that the demonstrations are continuing, but you're saying no?
There are small numbers here and there, 50 people, 80 people, 100 people, and they're carrying out attacks. So within less than 48 hours, almost 300 banks were destroyed, about 100 gas stations, many supermarkets, a medical laboratory was completely destroyed. So it was very violent, and large numbers of ambulances were destroyed, public buses. So these are not protests. These are riots. We're talking about violent rioters who carry swords, who have guns, and who carry iron bars, and they've beaten police officers to death.
We're hearing reports, though, that the 100 deaths, as Amnesty International describes the number, as being peaceful protesters, not rioters.
No, Amnesty International, its information and its sources on Iran have always been biased. There is no information that over 100 protesters on the street were killed. These were violent riots. There are lots of images out there. These are not peaceful protests.
Sayed Mohammad Mirandi teaches at the University of Tehran. He's been speaking with us from Tehran. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
But not so fast, says Philippe Nassif. He's Amnesty International's advocacy director for the Middle East and North Africa.
We have verified video footage, eyewitness testimony from people on the ground, and information gathered from human rights activists outside of the country who've been able to receive some of these videos of very large peaceful demonstrations. Some of the demonstrations have indeed turned violent. Rocks have been thrown, stones have been thrown. There have been some minor clashes with police, but the disproportionate response, the use of force by security services, has led to the deaths of over 100 people. And it's simply not true to say that these have been all violent. And even in some small cases where they have turned violent, you do not shoot protesters with live ammunition and beat them and disappear them.
The internet has been shut down in Iran for several days. I mean, without that internet connection, how are you actually getting that information?
It's been very difficult to get the information. You're correct. There's a total internet shutdown. In fact, an entire telecommunications blackout that has been implemented by the Iranian government. However, there are handfuls of protesters or activists that are on the ground in Iran that have been able to use VPN in order to send information out and videos of the protests and even some of the actual images of the security services shooting people, in one case from a helicopter, a sniper from a helicopter shooting and targeting peaceful protesters on the ground.
How does Amnesty International describe the government's response to the demonstrations?
It's vicious. It violates international law. These are people that are largely protesting in a very peaceful manner. And the response of the government has been to beat the protesters, has been to shoot the protesters, in some cases with live ammunition, which is why we're seeing this large death toll. And we've seen bodies of protesters being taken away by security services, the members of security services, and they've even gone into hospitals, which is something that has happened before in the past in Iran, where they've gone into hospitals where the injured or indeed the dead are being kept and removing the bodies. It's a ghastly scene in some parts of Iran.
What sort of crisis is this creating for the government of Iran right now?
It looks to be that the Iranian government's relatively panicked. I mean, I think that they recognize that there's an economic situation in the country that they are really unable to solve. It's not the first round of protests that Iran has seen and the Iranian authorities have had to respond to, but this is seemingly the most widespread and the most serious scenes that we've seen in a very long time in Iran. And they seem to be relatively panicked, which is why I think you're seeing this automatic, vicious crackdown that is often having the security services resort to very violent means in order to suppress the protests, but it doesn't seem to be working.
Philippe Nassif, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the show, Helsinki throws a nightclub party trying to steal away some of Silicon Valley's thunder. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Finland is regularly voted the happiest place on Earth, a reputation that Helsinki is showing off to try and attract global startups through a new nonprofit called Slush.
Everyone is here in Helsinki, cold, gray, pretty much as advertised.
The sauna situation here is out of control.
Only at Slush, only at Finland.
Andreas Sarius, Slush's CEO. Andreas, thanks for being with us. What exactly is Slush?
Slush aims at practically just creating a better world for entrepreneurs. And our most visible tool for that is a big tech event, a gathering in Helsinki each year, which brings together this year 25,000 people from more than 130 different countries this year.
So you're advertising Helsinki as cold and gray, and maybe the saunas will help with that.
Yes, that's correct. Well, it serves us because we can keep everybody under the same roof and in one space. Maybe usually what people associate with the tech world is Silicon Valley, California, Bay Area, sunshine. And we have it a little bit different here. And it's just something that we've taken as a core part of our brand. So our visual outlook is quite dark. so we just ride on it.
I mean, one of the big pulls of Silicon Valley is access to venture capital. If you have a good idea in California, there are dozens of venture capitalists waiting to throw money at it. How can you compete with that in Helsinki?
Yeah, that's kind of what we've been trying to do with the event. So we create this little concentration in space and time where we bring a massive amount of people and capital under one roof and kind of try to increase the interconnectedness of people in this region. And sure enough, I mean, we've been able to attract the attention of all the top funds. We have Sir Michael Moritz of Sequoia coming over for this year and practically all the top funds globally.
So it also sounds like Slush is more like a nightclub than a tech conference. You're not just courting investors to come to Finland. You want people who want a party?
Well, I mean, it's a nice side thing, but it's actually not the core thing at all. It's dark, so there are no lights on. There's a lot of lasers. The air is a little bit hazy. So it's kind of a nightlife type of feeling when you go in there. And one funny quote from a friend of mine, actually, some years back, he said that it puts him like in this evening mood when it's easier to strike up a conversation with a stranger, even like starting from 8 a.m.
So give us the quick like elevator pitch. Why go to Helsinki for this conference?
You'll meet an exceptional concentration of people from a variety of different industries. So it's actually more venture capitalists than anywhere else on the planet under one roof for the couple of days. In addition to that, several thousands of entrepreneurs, policymakers, people from the creative industries, large corporate C-level executives, students, researchers from a variety of different fields. So it's hard to match the serendipity that happens to take place over here over the next couple of days.
And there's a sauna.
Yes, we actually have several saunas that you can go into or book beforehand if you're clever.
Andreas Sari, the CEO of Slush. That's a nonprofit in Helsinki working to attract global startups. Andreas Sari, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
From Finland, we head about as far as you can go to New Zealand, where the government there has set an ambitious linguistic target. By 2040, 1 million people should be able to speak the Maori language. It's part of a strategy to support indigenous identity in New Zealand. From Gisborne, New Zealand, Phil Mercer has that story.
Alien Weaponry is a Maori heavy metal band. Its album 2 went straight to number 1 in New Zealand. Its success is an unmistakable sign of the resilience of the Maori language. But census data has shown that the number of indigenous speakers in New Zealand has fallen. Glenys Philip Barbara, the former head of the Maori Language Commission, is, though, optimistic about the future.
There aren't as many people speaking Maori as I'd like. I mean, around 2 in 5 Maori can have a conversation in Te Reo Maori, which is still quite low. But look, we've made huge gains since the days when we were at 2%. That was the 1970s. So we are steadily growing. And, of course, without a proper command of the language, you don't actually have that in-depth understanding of your own culture.
Ko te kai taunaki te reo Māori ko Alana Thomas tērā, e whakapau kahana ki a puiui o te reo I tōna kāinga.
Māori TV is publicly funded. Its presenters and journalists speak only in Māori. It's a far cry from when children were beaten or whipped for speaking their native tongue.
I think for a lot of people in this country, they lost the language through no fault of their own. So in New Zealand, we had generations of people who were punished for speaking their language at school. That led to them, in their adult years, making active choices not to teach their children the language so that their children wouldn't be hurt or harmed as a consequence. So it set up this negative reinforcement around the language. So many people like me were born without speaking Māori. When you think about that policy of strapping children for speaking their native language, that's certainly both an example of active colonisation practice and racism.
Forced to live in a white man's ideology. More plans are following religious idiocracies. I'ma take you back to Māori archaeology. When the Queen sent the ship to steal the Māori property.
The language is everything. We have a saying, if we lose our language, then we lose ourselves, like we lost the moa, which is a bird that went extinct.
Tina Garter is an Indigenous rights campaigner. She believes colonisation has had terrible consequences for language.
We talk about this idea of cultural genocide, and that one of the forms that colonisation takes is that the policies, the legislation, the funding, the structures really lean itself towards only letting you survive if you survive as a colonial version of yourself, and it's much more difficult to survive as a Māori.
Like many other New Zealanders, the Prime Minister, Jacinta Ardern, is eager to learn.
In New Zealand, there is a Māori proverb, He aha te mea nui o te ao. What is the most important thing in the world? He tangata, he tangata, he tangata. It is the people, the people, the people.
It's not too late for me, you know, and I'm chipping away at it, but the funny thing about it, I'm going to learn from my grandchildren.
Tutugaramu is a North Island community leader. He didn't have the chance to learn Māori as a child, but believes the future of the language is safely secured in the hands of younger generations.
We've got these little language nests, and they're called the kohanga reo, the version of kindergarten preschool, but it's our version, and we speak totally te reo to our babies. When they're 5 years old, that's when we start teaching them to speak te reo. A lot of our kids now, they're all really fluent, so the language is coming back now. But I was a missed generation.
Aku moi moia, so my aspiration for the future. Kia reo Māori te katoa, which means we all speak te reo Māori. Kia whai ora, ngā tangata katoa, so that everyone is well and healthy and living their best version of their lives. Kia tau te Māori o te hapori, which means that people within the community are living in peace.
Words such as kia ora, hello, and kai food have long been part of New Zealand English. It's hoped that by 2040, 1 million Kiwis will be able to speak basic Māori.
The BBC's Phil Mercer there, reporting from Gisborne, New Zealand. You're with the world. Today's impeachment inquiry zeroes in on the question, who gave the orders?
Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and I worked with Mr. Rudy Giuliani on Ukraine matters at the express direction of the President of the United States.
More on Ambassador Gordon Sondland's testimony coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Now back to the Capitol.
Committee will come to order.
Joining us to share a diplomat's perspective on the impeachment proceedings so far is Stephen Pfeiffer. He was a U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000.
I served in the as a career foreign service officer for 27 years. I've never seen anything like this. Career foreign service officers, career diplomats, have a duty to carry out the policy of the president. That's what we sign on to, and that's part of our role, to provide the president with a professional diplomatic corps, whether he or she is a Republican or a Democrat. But I would argue that the president owes it to the Foreign Service, but more importantly, the president owes it to the American people to be asking them to carry out policies that are in the American interest, not, in this case, President Trump's personal political interest.
Did anything in Sondland's testimony kind of move the needle in your mind on whether a quid pro quo took place around the White House meeting in military aid?
In July, the focus was just on the White House meeting. it's important not to underestimate just how important that meeting was to the Ukrainians. You have President Zelensky, he's been in office just 2 months. Being able to sit down in the Oval Office with the American president is really important, both for his domestic credibility, but also to send a signal to Russians and to Vladimir Putin. So there was that, and it then goes back to the president's call on July 25. In that call, President Trump is not asking about the conflict with Russia. He's not trying to get better trade terms for American companies. He's not suggesting that the United States could sell more liquefied natural gas to Ukraine. Those would all be in the American interest. Instead, what he's talking about is this investigation into Burisma and the Bidens and an investigation into CrowdStrike, both of which are long discredited theories. And those are in the personal political interest of the president, not the U.S. government's.
Well, here's Sondland talking about that July 25th phone call between Trump and Zelensky. Let's hear that.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call.
Everybody was in the loop. That is a refrain Sondland repeated several times. What do you make of that? Does the fact that everyone was allegedly in the loop make things better in your mind or worse?
I think what Ambassador Sondland is trying to do is saying that he was not acting as a rogue agent, that he was doing things on direction of the president and also with the knowledge of the leadership of both the National Security Council staff and also of the Secretary of the Department of State. I think it makes things look a bit worse because this story now involves many more senior officials as having been in on it than we knew was the case, say, yesterday.
So part of Republican counsel Steve Kastor's line of questioning was that Trump's push to investigate the Ukrainian energy company Burisma was a legitimate stand-in for corruption concerns. Is there something to that? Do you find that credible?
Not really. If you're going to look at corruption concerns in Ukraine, there are a whole raft of issues. And it just seems to be peculiar in this sense that Rudy Giuliani and the president picked out Burisma. I mean, the only real reason there that would set that corrupt issue apart from other companies would be the involvement of Hunter Biden on its board.
So, Ambassador, you've worked in the Foreign Service most of your life. How stunning is what you heard today in terms of diplomacy?
I was in Kyiv about 2.5 weeks ago, and I can say the Ukrainians are nervous about this. They're asking, what does this mean in terms of American support for Ukraine at a time when they see the United States as their main geopolitical counterbalance to Russia? And when President Zelensky is getting ready for his first face-to-face meeting with President Putin, along with the leaders of France and Germany in just a couple of weeks.
Stephen Pfeiffer is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He's now a research fellow at Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up later in the show,
Burisma.
That's right, Burisma. We go beyond the Biden connections. We're looking at the environmental impacts that the Ukrainian gas company has on eastern Ukraine. The impeachment inquiry is sure to be a big topic tonight in Atlanta. 10 Democratic presidential hopefuls are sharing the debate stage there. But the optics will be much different than what happened in the UK last night. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Across the pond, there's a lot more elbow room on the debate stage for the candidates for British Prime Minister.
We're live in Salford for a TV first. It's Boris Johnson versus Jeremy Corbyn.
Just two candidates on the stage? How novel. But there was also a third party making some noise, the audience.
Does the truth matter in this election?
I think it does. And I think it very important. I think it very important to hear from, I've been very clear about the deal that I've done.
That was Prime Minister Boris Johnson answering the moderator. And remember, Johnson called this election to get closer to a Brexit deal. Naturally, that's where last night's debate began. Johnson pressed his challenger on that.
Mr. Corbyn is trying to conceal the void at the heart of his Brexit policy and refusing to answer the question of which side he would take. Because the public have a right to know.
Corbyn, just very briefly,
I've made the position clear. We will have a referendum, we will have negotiation, and we will abide by that result. It's the British people who will make that decision.
The debate then turned to the National Health Service, the NHS, and Jeremy Corbyn brought the ammunition. He held some paper in the air, then accused Prime Minister Johnson of wanting to sell off the NHS to U.S. healthcare firms.
A document here of U.S.-UK negotiations, summary of specific negotiations.
Let's allow Mr.
Full
Johnson.
Market access for U.S. products to our National Health Service. You're going to sell
Johnson
our National Health Service out to the United States and Big Pharma.
Corbyn said Johnson is selling British health care to pharmaceutical companies. Johnson said that claim is an absolute invention.
It is completely untrue. There are no circumstances whatever in which this government or any Conservative government will put the NHS on the table in any trade negotiation. Our NHS will never be for sale.
Televised election debates are actually relatively new in the UK. The first one ever was just 9 years ago, a half a century after the first televised US debate. Last night, the moderator tried to bring some civility to the stage.
Perhaps, gentlemen, could you shake hands to make a pledge to improve politics?
And a gesture, Look,
Thank you very much indeed.
Johnson and Corbyn did shake hands there. British voters can watch more televised debates before the election in 3 weeks. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Believe it or not, Congress has been doing other things this week besides the impeachment hearings. The Senate passed a bill with unanimous consent supporting human rights in Hong Kong. Republican Senator Marco Rubio sponsored it.
The people of Hong Kong see what's coming. They see the steady effort to erode the autonomy and their freedoms. And the response by the Hong Kong authorities under tremendous pressure from Beijing is violence and repression.
According to the bill, if China erodes Hong Kong's autonomy, Hong Kong could lose its special trade status with the U.S. The House of Representatives has also passed a similar measure. The two bills first need to be reconciled before anything is sent to President Trump's desk. Complicating matters, Trump will also be working on a trade deal with China. The U.S. isn't the only country charting a tricky course with Hong Kong and China. A former employee at the United Kingdom's Hong Kong consulate says Chinese authorities detained him on a work trip to mainland China in August, then tortured him. Simon Chang told his story to the BBC's John Sudworth.
I've been shackled, I've been handcuffed, and I've been blindfolded, and also they make me hooded.
They put a hood on your head?
Yes. And then they start the torture, for example, like to put me hands up, handcuff, and for several hours, and then you feel very painful.
The British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, said he was outraged.
I summoned the Chinese ambassador to see me, and we've made clear not only that this is outrageous and disgraceful behaviour, but also that we expect the Chinese authorities to review and to hold to account those responsible, as is their obligation under international law.
A spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Gong Shuang, dismissed the allegations as well as the official British government reaction. Shuang said, we express our great indignation toward the UK's recent series of mistaken remarks and actions. China has accused Britain and the US of encouraging pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. The protests have been going on now for 7 months. It's no secret. Across the world, many governments face accusations of human rights violations. Yes, even the U.S. And activists fight back. When it comes to animal rights, there's also a movement to fight for their rights. The World's Rupa Shenoy has a story of the orangutan that has emerged as a symbol of that movement.
For years, people said Sandra looked depressed. She'd sit outside in the rain and snow, her shaggy red hair damp and matted. She neglected Max, who was supposed to be her mate. Visitors to the Buenos Aires Zoo said Sandra seemed lonely, even though orangutans usually prefer to be solitary, high in the trees. Activists worried Sandra's accommodations were inadequate. They sued.
A court in Argentina is to rule on whether an allegedly depressed orangutan named Sandra is entitled to certain human rights.
In 2015, a judge in Argentina made international news by declaring Sandra a non-human person and sentient being with legal rights. Her attorney, Andrés Gil Domínguez, said the ruling would influence other cases and spread the idea that confinement violates sentient animals' rights. Since then, a chimpanzee named Cecilia has also been declared a non-human person in Argentina. A court in Colombia has recognized the legal rights of a bear named Chucho. That's surprising, considering courts have only been hearing cases like this for a few years, says Matthew Liebman of the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
The animal law movement really grew out of the United States, but the most remarkable progress we've seen has been outside of the United States with things like the Sandra case in South America.
Yet nothing changed for Sandra for years. She was still stuck in the Buenos Aires Zoo.
We did not solicit having her come here because I didn't think it was possible.
Patty Reagan founded the Center for Great Apes in Florida. It has more than 60 orangutan and chimpanzee refugees from circuses or people's former pets, including Bubbles, who belonged to Michael Jackson.
We are the only orangutan sanctuary that is accredited in North and South America.
But Reagan knew it would be a huge process to meet U.S. requirements to get Sandra into the country. Still, Sandra didn't have many options. Orangutans are highly endangered. Their forest habitats in Indonesia are disappearing, and Sandra never lived in the wild. Plus, she's a hybrid of two orangutan species, and Indonesia has banned orangutans like her from its sanctuaries.
After looking at several options for Sandra, around the world, actually, they asked us again to please take her.
Now, at 33 years old, Sandra has finally arrived home.
She walked into her room. She was just engaged and interested, very calm, foraged around for food in the hay and got some blankets, went up and made a nest that night and slept well.
Sounds like a happy ending, right? For some animal rights activists, though, there's still a lingering question.
The question is, if she was a person in Argentina, does that mean she's a person within the United States?
Stephen Wise says no one knows yet. He's head of the nonprofit Non-Human Rights Project, currently teaching animal rights jurisprudence at Tel Aviv University, and he's fighting for personhood for animals in several cases. He hopes bringing up Sandra's case will help sway judges, even if it doesn't serve officially as a precedent.
We're not saying that they're bound by that. We're simply saying that the world is changing outside of your courtroom, and you may want to change with it.
So far, American judges haven't been persuaded by Weiss's arguments. Kristen Stilt is director of the Animal Law and Policy Program at Harvard Law.
You almost get a sense that judges are really looking for reasons not to do what he's asking. One of the reasons, which is, well, they're just being transferred to another form of captivity. They're not being freely released.
Judges may make a different decision if public attitude shifts, she says. And that's why other activists say Sandra is most important as a symbol.
If we care about Sandra, why don't we care about all of them?
Marianne Sullivan is a lecturer in animal law at Columbia Law School and co-host of the Animal Law Podcast. She points out that these court cases only apply to individual animals, not animals as a class.
Animals live and die in hidden factory farms and hidden laboratories. They're not going to court. So, yeah, we're not going to solve this in the courts. People have to solve it in their hearts, in their behavior, and, you know, politically in passing laws.
As for Sandra the orangutan, for the first time in her life, no one's watching. She's exploring an aerial network of tunnels at the Center for Great Apes and hanging out in her own heated and cooled indoor and outdoor spaces. Director Patty Reagan says that lifestyle costs about $20,000 a year. The center's funded by donations and grants and isn't open to the public. Reagan also says Sandra doesn't have to worry about being pushed into mating.
We don't breed because to raise another baby just to be in captivity is really, you know, is not the right thing to do.
But there is an orangutan Reagan hopes Sandra might be interested in.
One that I would love to see her like, if she so chooses, Jethro, very sweet, quiet male, but if she doesn't like him, we have other males and females that she may enjoy living with.
If she does like Jethro, though, Sandra should know. He's had a female companion for years, but
he's interested in a younger male right now.
Turns out things get complicated when apes have rights and choices. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Catch a glimpse of Sandra in her new home. It even comes equipped with a kiddie pool. That's at theworld.org. Back to our top story today. U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, appeared at the impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill. He gave explicit documented testimony about the direct involvement of President Trump in the Ukraine scandal.
Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and I worked with Mr. Rudy Giuliani on Ukraine matters at the express direction of the President of the United States. We did not want to work with Mr. Giuliani. Simply put, we were playing the hand we were dealt.
At the heart of the impeachment case is whether President Trump abused his office to gain political favors. Three Latin words, quid pro quo. Sondland was unequivocal on that.
The answer is yes.
The ambassador documented that high-ranking members of the Trump administration also knew about this quid pro quo. Sondland supported his testimony with new documents, emails, texts, and other messages. But he said that he and his staff have been blocked from getting other records by their superiors at the State Department. That led Committee Chair Democrat Adam Schiff to warn the president and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about withholding requested documents.
They do so at their own peril. I remind the president that Article 3 of the impeachment articles drafted against President Nixon was his refusal to obey the subpoenas of Congress.
The Republican response today has been to try to raise doubts about the witness and his memory. Ranking Member Devin Nunes also attacked the process.
The American people sent us to Washington to solve problems, not to wage scorched earth political warfare against the other party. This impeachment is not helping the American people. It's not a legitimate use of taxpayer dollars, and it's definitely not improving our national security.
Nunes said partisan extremists have hijacked the House Intelligence Committee. As for President Trump, he briefly spoke with reporters from the White House lawn. He quoted a part of Sondland's testimony where Sondland said the president told him in September on a brief phone call that he wanted nothing from Ukraine's president. Then Trump added this about Sondland.
I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. This is not a man I know well. Seems like a nice guy, though. But I don't know him well.
Sondland donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration committee. In his testimony today, Sondland said the two men have spoken at least 20 times. Sondland has also flown on Air Force One with the president. There was another name we also heard over and over today, Burisma.
But you would ultimately learn that Burisma meant the Bidens when you saw the call record, correct?
Of course. Today I know exactly what it means.
That's Adam Schiff and Sondland in a back and forth, agreeing that Burisma means the Bidens. Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, was paid handsomely to sit on Burisma's board. Every American, even paying superficial attention to the impeachment hearings, knows that. But for many Ukrainians, Burisma is just a natural gas company. And living near Burisma's rigs is making life difficult for people in one town in eastern Ukraine. The BBC's Zhanna Bezpiachuk has their story.
Burisma is the Ukrainian gas firm on everyone's lips in the United States. But here in eastern Ukraine, this is the sound you associate with it. I'm right beside a gas well, and Burisma is digging and drilling more for gas. It's right in the middle of a small village. Before you see the drilling, you can smell gas in the air. I've only been here a few minutes, but already my breathing feels a bit labored. Melania is a gray-haired woman in her 70s. She and her husband have retired and moved to this village, leaving behind a big apartment in the city for their children. Here, instead of quietness and comfort, so much needed and anticipated, the couple have found themselves in the shadow of Burisma. Melania claims gas extraction has polluted the groundwater and partly dried up the well. She drags a half-empty bucket out of the well.
You see, before the water used to be near the top, but now it's near the bottom.
Ukrainian environmentalists say that drilling for gas and taking it from the ground pollutes the drinking water in this eastern Ukrainian region. They say it also causes the groundwater level to drop. Although formally gas extraction is done in line with Ukrainian environmental laws, the actual implementation of these rules still lags far behind US and European standards. Nadia Rikusova is studying the environmental impact of gas extraction at the Kharkiv Polytechnic Institute in eastern Ukraine for her PhD.
Waste water and waste materials seeps into the nearby wells. This has a negative impact on local people and plants. The water gradually becomes polluted and unsuitable for drinking.
This is a poor area to start with. Windows in ramshackle houses are patched up with rags. The average income here is $150 a month. It's estimated that Hunter Biden, the son of former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, received over $50,000 a month for sitting on Burisma's board. He spent 5 years on it, and experts say he has not broken any Ukrainian law. But this is of little comfort to Melania. She proudly shows me her neat yard. Water is not the only problem. Damaged roads are the other big issue here.
The company's trucks destroy the roads, so we can't drive in winter or in summer after the rain.
In previous statements, Burisma has said it follows all the environmental rules. But locals say the drilling takes place too close to their homes. 80-year-old Mikola shows me around his garden. He points at the Burisma gas rig, just around 400 meters away.
This is my garden. There's the gas well.
Critics of Hunter Biden say he traded on the name of his father for a role with a firm whose owner was investigated for tax evasion, the awarding of gas licenses, and money laundering. Ukrainian prosecutors have closed down all these investigations. Now President Trump has accused Joe Biden of getting the Ukrainian chief prosecutor sacked in 2016 so he could halt an investigation into Burisma to protect his son. The former U.S. vice president and Democratic contender denies these claims. At the same time, members of the international community agreed with Mr. Biden that the prosecutor was not doing enough to tackle corruption. But for people who must live beside the gas well, life continues as it is. They don't even have a gas supply themselves. The BBC put the people's environmental claims to Burisma, but have not received a response.
That's the BBC's Zhanna Bezpiachuk reporting from eastern Ukraine. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.